Chapter 3. Warm Hospitality. 1. The chamber was a rough brick cube about 8 feet on a side. It was completely dark, and an arid sauna heat was radiating from the walls, which were too hot to touch for more than a few seconds. Locke and Jean had been sweltering inside it for only the gods knew how long, probably hours. "Ah!" Locke's voice was cracked. He and Jean were seated back to back in the blackness, leaning against each other for support, with their folded coats beneath them. Locke beat his heels against the stones of the floor, not for the first time. "God damn it!" Locke yelled. "Let us out! You've made your point!" "What point?" rasped Jean. "Could that possibly be?" "I don't know," Locke coughed. "I don't care. Whatever it is, they've damn well made it, don't you think?" 2. The removal of their hoods had been a relief for about 2 heartbeats. First had come an interminable interval spent stumbling around in stifling darkness, pulled and prodded along by captors who seemed to be in some haste. Next, there was indeed a boat ride. Locke could smell the warm salt mists rising off the city's harbour, while the deck swayed gently beneath him and oars creaked rhythmically in their locks. Eventually, that too came to an end. The boat rocked as someone rose and moved about. The oars were drawn in, and an unfamiliar voice called for poles. A few moments later, the boat bumped against something, and strong hands again hoisted Locke to his feet. When he'd been helped from the boat to a firm stone surface, the hood was suddenly whisked off his head. He looked around, blinked at the sudden light, and said, "Oh, shit!" At the heart of Tal Vahrar, between the 3 crescent islands of the great guilds, lay the Castellana, fortified estate of the dukes of Tal Vahrar centuries earlier. Now that the city had dispensed with titled nobility, the mansion-covered Castellana was home to a new breed of well-heeled gentry, the priori councillors, the independently rich, and those guildmasters whose social positions required the most ostentatious displays of spending power. At the very heart of the Castellana, guarded by a moat of empty air like a circular elderglass canyon, was the Mon Magisteria, the palace of the Archon, a towering human achievement springing upward from alien grandeur, an elegant stone weed growing in a glass garden. Locke and Jean had been brought to a point directly beneath it. Locke guessed that they stood within the hollow space that separated the Mon Magisteria from the surrounding island. A million-faceted cavern of darkened elderglass soared upward around them, and the open air of the upper island lay 50 or 60 feet above their heads. The channel that the boat had travelled through wound away to his left, and the sound of the lapping water was drowned out by a distant rumbling noise with no visible cause. There was a wide stone landing at the base of the Mon Magisteria's private island, with several boats tied up alongside it, including an enclosed ceremonial barge with silk awnings and gilded woodwork. Soft blue alchemical lamps in iron posts filled the space with light, and behind those posts 12 soldiers stood at attention. Even if a quick glance upward hadn't told Locke the identity of their captor, those soldiers would have revealed everything. They wore dark blue doublets and breeches, with black leather braces, vests, and boots all chased with raised designs in gleaming brass. Blue hoods were drawn up around the backs of their heads, and their faces were covered with featureless oval masks of polished bronze. Grids of tiny pinholes permitted them to see and breathe, but from a distance every impression of humanity was erased. The soldiers were faceless sculptures brought to life. The eyes of the Archon.
"Here you are then, Master Costa, Master de Ferra."
The woman who'd waylaid Locke and Jean stepped up onto the landing between them and took them by the elbows, smiling as though they were out for a night on the town.
"Is this not a more private place for a conversation?"
"What," said Jean, "have we done to warrant our transport here?"
I'm the wrong person to ask, said the woman as she pushed them gently forward. My job is to retrieve and deliver.
She released Locke and Jean just before the front rank of the Archon's soldiers. Their own disquieted expressions were reflected back at them in a dozen gleaming bronze masks.
And sometimes, said the woman as she returned to the boat, when guests don't come back out again, my job is to forget that I ever saw them at all.
The eyes of the Archon moved without apparent signal. Locke and Jean were enveloped and secured by several soldiers apiece. One of them spoke, another woman, her voice echoing ominously.
We will go up. You must not struggle and you must not speak.
Or what? Said Locke. The eye who'd spoken stepped over to Jean without hesitation and punched him in the stomach. The big man exhaled in surprise and grimaced while the female eye turned back to Locke.
If either of you causes any trouble, I'm instructed to punish the other one. Do I make myself clear?
Locke ground his teeth together and nodded. A wide set of switchback stairs led upward from the landing. The glass underfoot was rough as brick. Flight by flight, the Archon's soldiers led Locke and Jean up past gleaming walls until the moist night breeze of the city was on their faces once again. They emerged within the perimeter defined by the glass chasm. A guardhouse stood just this side of the 30-foot gap, beside a drawbridge currently hauled straight up into the air and set inside a heavy wood frame. Locke presumed that was the usual means of entrance to the Archon's domain. The Mon Magisteria was a ducal fortress in the true Therin throne style, easily 15 stories high at its peak and 3 or 4 times as wide. Layer after layer of crenellated battlements rose up, formed from flat black stones that seemed to absorb the fountains of light thrown up by dozens of lanterns burning on the castle's grounds. Columned aqueducts circled the walls and towers at every level, and decorative streams of water cascaded down from sculptures of dragons and sea monsters set at the fortress corners. The eyes of the Archon led Locke and Jean toward the front of the palace, down a wide path dusted with white gravel. There were lush green lawns on either side of the path, set behind decorative stone borders that made the lawns seem like islands. More blue-robed and black-armored guards in bronze masks stood unmoving along the path, holding up blackened steel halberds with alchemical lights built into their wooden shafts. Where most castles would have a front gate, the Mon Magisteria had a rushing waterfall wider than the path on which they stood. This was the source of the noise Locke had heard echoing at the boat landing below. Multiple torrents of water crashed out of huge dark apertures set in a line running straight up the castle wall. These joined and fell into a churning moat at the very base of the structure, a moat even wider than the glass-sided canyon that cut the castle grounds off from the rest of the Castellana. A bridge, slightly arched, vanished into the pounding white waterfall about halfway over the moat. Warm mist wafted up around them as their party approached the edge of this bridge, which Locke could now see had some sort of niche cut into it, running right down its centre for its full visible length. Beside the bridge was an iron pull chain hanging from the top of a narrow stone pillar. The eye officer reached up for this and gave it 3 swift tugs. A moment later, there came a metallic rattling noise from the direction of the bridge. A dark shape loomed within the waterfall, grew, and then burst out toward them with mist and water exploding off its roof. It was a giant box of iron-ribbed wood, 15 feet high and as wide as the bridge. Rumbling, it slid along the track carved into the bridge until it halted with a squeal of metal on metal just before them. Doors popped open toward them, pushed from the inside by 2 attendants in dark blue coats with silver braid trim. Locke and Jean were ushered into the roomy conveyance, which had windows set into the end facing the castle. Through them, Locke could see nothing but rushing water. The waterfall pounded off the roof. The noise was like being in a carriage during a heavy storm. When Locke and Jean and all the eyes had stepped into the box, the attendants drew the doors closed. One of them pulled a chain set into the right-hand wall, and with a lurching rumble, the box was drawn back to where it had come from. As they passed through it, Locke guessed that the waterfall was 15 to 20 feet long. An unprotected man would never be able to pass it without being knocked into the moat, which he supposed was precisely the point. That, and it was a hell of a way to show off. They soon pushed through the other side of the falls. Locke could see that they were being drawn into a huge hemispherical hall, with a curved far wall and a ceiling about 30 feet high. Alchemical chandeliers shed light on the hall, silver and white and gold, so that the place gleamed like a treasure vault through the distortion of the water-covered windows. When the conveyor box ground to a halt, the attendants manipulated unseen latches to crack open the forward windows like a pair of giant doors. Locke and Jean were prodded out of the box, but more gently than before. The stones at their feet were slick with water, and they followed the example of the guards in treading carefully. The waterfall roared at their back for a moment longer, and then two huge doors slammed together behind the conveyor box, and the deafening noise became a dull echo. Some sort of water engine could be seen in a wall niche to Locke's left. Several men and women stood before gleaming cylinders of brass, working levers attached to mechanical contrivances whose functions were well beyond Locke's capability to guess. Heavy iron chains disappeared into dark holes in the floor, just beside the track the huge wooden box rode in. Jean, too, cocked his head for a closer look at this curiosity. But once past the danger of the slick stones, the soldier's brief spate of tolerance passed, and they shoved the two thieves along at a good clip once again. Through the entrance hall, wide and grand enough to host several balls at once, they passed at speed. The hall had no windows open to the outside, but rather artificial panoramas of stained glass lit from behind. Each window seemed to be a stylized view of what would be seen through a real hole cut in the stone. White buildings and mansions, dark skies, the tiers of islands across the harbour, dozens of sails in the main anchorage. Locke and Jean were escorted down a side hall, up a flight of steps and down another hall, past blue-coated guards standing stiffly at attention. Was it Locke's imagination, or did something more than ordinary respect creep into their faces when the bronze masks of the eyes swept past them? There was no more time to ponder, for they were suddenly halted before their evident destination. In a corridor full of wooden doorways, they stood before one made of metal. An eye stepped forward, unlocked the door, and pushed it open. The room beyond was small and dark. Soldiers rapidly undid the bonds on Locke and Jean's hands, and then the two of them were shoved forward into the little room.
"Hey, wait just a damn,"
said Locke, but the door slammed shut behind them, and the sudden blackness was absolute.
"Perelandro," said Jean.
He and Locke spent a few seconds stumbling into each other before they managed to regain some balance and dignity.
"How on earth did we attract the attention of these bloody assholes?"
"I don't know, Jerome,"
Locke emphasized the pseudonym very slightly, "but maybe the walls have ears."
"Hey, bloody assholes! No need to be coy. We're perfectly well behaved when civilly incarcerated."
Locke stumbled toward the remembered location of the nearest wall to pound his fists against it. He discovered for the first time that it was rough brick.
"Damnation,"
he muttered, and sucked at a scraped knuckle.
"Odd," said Jean.
"What?"
"I can't be sure."
"What?
Is it just me, or does it seem to be getting warmer in here?"
3. Time went by with all the speed of a sleepless night. Locke was seeing colours flashing and wobbling in the darkness, and while part of him knew they weren't real, that part of him was getting less and less assertive with every passing minute. The heat was like a weight pressing in on every inch of his skin. His tunic was wide open, and he'd slipped his neckcloths off so he could wrap them around his hands to steady himself as he leaned back against Jean. When the door clicked open, it took him a few seconds to realize that he wasn't imagining things. The crack of white light grew into a square, and he flinched back with his hands over his eyes. The air from the corridor fell across him like a cool autumn breeze.
"Gentlemen," said a voice from beyond the square of light, "there has been a terrible misunderstanding."
Was all the response Locke could muster as he tried to remember just how his knees worked. His mouth felt drier than if it had been packed with cornmeal. Strong, cool hands reached out to help him to his feet. The room swam around him as he and Jean were helped back out into the bliss of the corridor. They were surrounded once again by blue doublets and bronze masks, but Locke squinted against the light and felt more ashamed than afraid. He knew he was confused, almost as though he were drunk, and he was powerless to do anything more than grasp at the vague realization. He was carried along corridors and upstairs. Stairs! Gods! How many sets could there be in one bloody palace? With his legs only sometimes bearing their fair share of his weight, he felt like a puppet in a cruel comedy with an unusually large stage set.
"Water!"
he managed to gasp out.
"Soon," said one of the soldiers carrying him. "Very soon."
At last he and Jean were ushered through tall black doors into a softly lit office that seemed to have walls made up of thousands upon thousands of tiny glass cells filled with little flickering shadows. Locke blinked and cursed his condition. He'd heard sailors talk of dry drunk, the stupidity, weakness, and irritability that seized a man in great want of water, but he'd never imagined he'd experience it firsthand. It was making everything very strange indeed. No doubt it was embellishing the details of a perfectly ordinary room. The office held a small table and three plain wooden chairs. Locke steered himself toward one of them gratefully, but was firmly restrained and held upright by the soldiers at his arms.
"You must wait," said one of them.
Though not for long. A scant few heartbeats later, another door opened into the office. A man in long, fur-trimmed robes of deep water blue strode in, clearly agitated.
"Gods defend the Archon of Tal'Varar," said the four soldiers in unison.
"Maxilan Stragos," came Locke's dazed realization. "The God's damned supreme warlord of Tal'Varar."
"For pity's sake, let these men have their chairs," said the Archon. "We have already done them a grievous wrong, Sword Prefect. We shall now extend them every possible courtesy. After all, we are not Komori."
"Of course, Archon."
Locke and Jean were quickly helped into their seats. When the soldiers were reasonably certain that they wouldn't topple over immediately, they stepped back and stood at attention behind them. The Archon waved his hand irritably.
"Dismissed, Sword Prefect."
"But, Your Honor."
"Out of my sight. You have already conjured a serious embarrassment from my very clear instructions for these men. As a result, they are in no shape to be any threat to me."
"But, yes, Archon."
The Sword Prefect gave a stiff bow, which the other three soldiers repeated. The four of them hurriedly left the office, closing the door behind them with the elaborate click-clack of a clockwork mechanism.
"Gentlemen," said the Archon, "you must accept my deepest apologies. My instructions were misconstrued. You were to be given every courtesy. Instead, you were shown to the sweltering chamber, which is reserved for criminals of the lowest sort. I would trust my eyes to be the equal of 10 times their number in any fight, yet in this simple matter they have dishonored me. I must take responsibility. You must forgive this misunderstanding and allow me the honor of showing you a better sort of hospitality."
Locke mustered his will to attempt a suitable response and whispered a silent prayer of thanks to the crooked warden when Jean spoke first.
"The honor is ours, Protector.
His voice was hoarse, but his wits seemed to be returning faster than Locke's.
The chamber was a small price to pay for the pleasure of such an unexpected audience. There is nothing to forgive.
You are an uncommonly gracious man, said Stragos. Please dispense with the superfluities. It will do to call me Archon.
There was a soft knock at the door through which the Archon had entered the office.
Come, he said,
and in bustled a short, bald man in elaborate blue and silver livery. He carried a silver tray on which there were three crystal goblets and a large bottle of some pale amber liquid. Locke and Jean fixed their gazes on this bottle with the intensity of hunters about to fling their last javelins at some charging beast. When the servants set the tray down and reached for the bottle, the Archon gestured for him to withdraw and took up the bottle himself.
Go, he said. I am perfectly capable of serving these poor gentlemen myself.
The attendant bowed and vanished back through the door. Stragos withdrew the already loosened cork from the bottle and filled two goblets to their brims with its contents. That wet gurgle and splash brought an expectant ache to the insides of Locke's cheeks.
It is customary, said Stragos, for the host to drink first when serving in this city, to establish a basis for trust in what he happens to be serving.
He dashed two fingers of liquid into the third goblet, lifted it to his lips, and swallowed it at a gulp.
Ah,
he said, as he passed the full goblets over to Locke and Jean without further hesitation.
There now, drink up. No need to be delicate. I'm an old campaigner.
Locke and Jean were anything but delicate. They gulped down the offered drinks with grateful abandon. Locke wouldn't have cared if the offering had been squeezed earthworm juice, but it was in fact some sort of pear cider, with just the slightest bite. A child's liquor, barely capable of intoxicating a sparrow, and an astute choice, given their condition. The tart, cold cider coated the inside of Locke's tortured throat, and he shuddered with pleasure. He and Jean thrust out their empty goblets without thinking, but Stragos was already waiting with the bottle in hand. He refilled their cups, smiling benevolently. Locke inhaled half of his new goblet, then forced himself to make the second half last. Already a new strength seemed to be radiating outward from his stomach, and he sighed with relief.
"Many thanks, Archon," he said. "May I, presume to ask how Jerome and I have offended you?"
"Offended me? Not at all."
Stragos, still smiling, set down the bottle and seated himself behind the little table. He reached toward the wall and pulled a silk cord. A shaft of pale amber light fell from the ceiling, illuminating the center of the table.
"What you've done, young fellows, is catch my interest."
Stragos sat framed by the shaft of light, and Locke studied him for the first time. A man of very late middle years, surely nearing 60, if not already past it. A strangely precise man, with squared-off features. His skin was pink and weathered, his hair a flat grey roof. In Locke's experience, most powerful men were either ascetics or gluttons. Stragos seemed neither, a man of balance. And his eyes were shrewd, shrewd as a usurer with a client in need. Locke sipped at his pear cider and prayed for wit. The golden light was caught and reflected by the glass cells that walled the room, and when Locke let his eyes wander for a moment, he was startled to see their contents moving. The little fluttering shadows were butterflies, moths, beetles, hundreds of them, perhaps thousands, each one in its own little glass prison. The Archon's study was walled in with the largest insect collection Locke had ever heard of, let alone seen with his own eyes. Beside him, Jean gasped, evidently having noticed the same thing. The Archon chuckled indulgently.
"My collection! Is it not striking?"
He reached toward the wall again and pulled another silken cord. Soft white light grew behind the glass walls, until the full details of each specimen became plainly visible. There were butterflies with scarlet wings, blue wings, green wings, some with multicolored patterns more intricate than tattoos. There were gray, black, and gold moths with curled antennae. There were beetles with burnished carapaces that gleamed like precious metals, and wasps with translucent wings flickering above their sinister, tapered bodies.
"It's incredible," said Locke. "How can it be possible?"
"Oh, it isn't. They're all artificial. The best artistry and artisanry can provide. A clockwork mechanism several floors below works a set of bellows, sending gusts of air up shafts behind the walls of this office. Each cell has a tiny aperture at the rear. The fluttering of the wings seems quite random and realistic. In semi-darkness, one might never realize the truth."
"It's no less incredible," said Jean.
"Well, this is the city of artifice," said the Archon. "Living creatures can require such tedious care. You might think of my Mon Magisteria as a repository of artificial things. Here, drink up, and let me pour you the last of the bottle."
Locke and Jean obliged, and Stragos was able to give them each a few fingers more before the bottle was drained. He settled himself back down behind his table and pulled something off the silver tray, a slim phial of some sort, wrapped in a brown cover with broken wax seals on three sides.
"Artificial things. Just as you are artificial things, Master Costa and Master de Ferra. Or should I say, Master Lamora and Master Tannen?"
If Locke had possessed the strength to crush heavy Verari crystal with his bare hands, the Archon would have lost a goblet.
"I beg your pardon," said Locke, adopting a helpful, slightly confused smile, "but I don't know anyone by those names. Jerome?"
"There must be some mistake," said Jean, picking up Locke's exact tone of polite bewilderment.
"No mistake, gentlemen," said the Archon.
He slipped the phial open and briefly examined the contents, about a dozen pages of parchment covered in neat black script.
"I received a very curious letter several days ago, through secure channels with my intelligence apparatus, a letter rich with the most singular collection of stories. From a personal acquaintance, a source within the hierarchy of the Bonds Magi of Carthane."
Not even Jean's hands could squeeze a Ferrari crystal goblet to fragments, Locke thought, or that moment might have seen the Archon's office decorated with an exploding cloud of shards and blood. Locke gamely raised an eyebrow, refusing to give in just yet.
"The Bonds Magi? Gods, that sounds ominous. But, what would Bonds Magi have to do with Jerome and myself?"
Stragos stroked his chin while he skimmed the documents in the file.
"Apparently you're both thieves from some sort of secret enclave, formerly operating out of the House of Perelandro in Camor's Temple District. Cheeky, that. You operated without the permission of Kappa Vencarlo Barsavi, no longer among the breathing. You stole tens of thousands of crowns from several dons of Camor. You are jointly responsible for the death of one Luciano Anatolius, a buccaneer captain who hired a bondsmage to aid his plans. Perhaps most importantly, you foiled those plans and crippled that bondsmage. Overcame him at close quarters. Extraordinary. You shipped him back to Carthane half dead and quite mad. No fingers, no tongue."
"Actually, Leo Canto and I are from Talisham, and we're..."
"You're both from Camor. Jean Esteban Tannen, which is your real name, and Locke Lamora, which isn't yours. That's emphasized for some reason. You're in my city as part of a scheme against that scrub Requin. Supposedly, you've been making preparations to break into his vault. Best of luck there. Need we continue with your charade? I have many more details. It seems that the Bonds Magi have it in for you.
Those assholes, muttered Locke.
I see you are personally acquainted with them, said Strogoz. I've hired a few of them in the past. They're a touchy bunch. So you'll admit to the truth of this report? Come, Requin is no friend of mine. He's in with the Priori. Might as well be on their damn councils.
Locke and Jean looked at each other, and Jean shrugged. Very well, said Locke. You seem to have us at quite a disadvantage, Archon.
To be precise, I have you at 3. I have this report extensively documenting your activities. I have you here at the center of all my power. And now, for the sake of my own comfort, I have you on a leash.
Meaning what? Said Locke.
Perhaps my eyes did not embarrass me, gentlemen. Perhaps you too were intended to spend a few hours in the sweltering chamber to help you work up a thirst that needed quenching.
He gestured at Locke and Jean's goblets, which now held only dregs.
You put something else in the cider, said Jean.
Of course, said Strogoz. An excellent little poison.
4. For a moment the room was utterly silent, save for the soft fluttering of artificial insect wings. Then Locke and Jean stumbled up from their chairs in unison, but Strogoz didn't so much as twitch.
Sit down, unless you'd prefer not to hear exactly what's going on.
You drank from the same bottle, said Locke, still standing.
Of course I did. It wasn't actually in the cider. It was in your goblets, painted into the bottoms, colourless and tasteless. A proprietary alchemical substance, quite expensive. You should be flattered. I've increased your net personal worth.
I know a thing or two about poisons. What is it?
What would be the sense in telling you anything more? You might attempt to have someone assemble an antidote. As it stands, your only possible source for your antidote is me.
He smiled, every pretense of contrite gentility shed from his features like a molted insect's husk. A very different Strogoz was with them now, and there was a lash in his voice.
Sit down! You're at my disposal now, obviously. You're not what I might have wanted by the gods, but perhaps just what I can best put to use.
Locke and Jean settled back down into their chairs uneasily. Locke threw his goblet down onto the carpet, where it bounced and rolled to a halt beside Strogoz's table.
You might as well know, said Locke, that I've been poisoned for coercive purposes before.
Have you? How convenient. Then surely you'll agree it's better than being poisoned for murderous ones.
What would you have us do?
Something useful, said Strogoz. Something grand. According to this report, you're the Thorn of Camor. My agents brought me stories of you, the most ridiculous rumours which now turn out to have been true. I thought you were a myth.
The Thorn of Camor is a myth, said Locke, and it was never just me. We've always worked as a group, as a team.
Of course. No need to stress Master Tannen's importance to me. It's all here in this file. I shall keep you both alive while I prepare for the task I have in mind for you. I'm not ready to discuss it yet, so let us say that I'm keeping you on retainer in the meantime. Go about your business. When I call, you will come.
Will we? Spat Locke.
Oh, it's well within your power to leave the city. And if you do, you will both die rather slow and miserable deaths before another season passes, and that would disappoint us all.
You could be bluffing, said Jean.
Yes, yes, but if you're rational men, a bluff would hold you as surely as a real poison, would it not? But come now, Tannen, I have the resources not to bluff.
And what's to keep us from running after we've received the antidote?
The poison is latent, Lamora. It slumbers within the body for many, many months, if not years. I will dole out your antidote at intervals so long as you please me.
And what guarantee do we have that you'll continue to give us the antidote once we've done whatever task you'd set us to?
You have none.
And no better alternatives?
Of course not.
Locke closed his eyes and gently massaged them with the knuckles of his index fingers. Your alleged poison. Will it interfere with our daily lives in any way? Will it complicate matters of judgment, agility, or health?
Not at all, said Stragos. You won't notice a thing until the time for the antidote is well past, and then you'll notice a great deal all at once. Until then, your affairs will be unimpeded.
But you have already impeded our affairs, said Jean. We're at a very delicate point in our dealings with Requin.
He gave us strict orders, said Locke, to do nothing suspicious while he sniffs around our recent activities. Disappearing from the streets in the care of the Archon's people would probably qualify as suspicious.
Already taken into consideration, said the Archon. Most of the people who pulled you two off the street are in one of Requin's gangs. He just doesn't know they work for me. They'll report seeing you out and about, even if others do not.
Are you confident that Requin is blind to their true loyalty?
Gods bless your amusing insolence, Lamora, but I'm not going to justify my every order to you. You'll accept them like my other soldiers, and if you must trust, trust in the judgment that has kept me seated as Archon for 15 years.
It's our lives under Requin's thumb if you're wrong, Stragos.
It's your lives under my thumb, regardless.
Requin is no fool.
Then why are you attempting to steal from him?
We flatter ourselves, said Jean, that we're...
I'll tell you why, Stragos interrupted. He closed his file and folded his hands atop it. You're not just greedy. You two have an unhealthy lust for excitement. The contemplation of long odds must positively get you drunk. Or else why choose the life you have, when you could have obviously succeeded as thieves of a more mundane stripe, within the limits allowed by that Barsavi?
If you think that little pile of papers gives you enough knowledge to presume so much...
You two are risk-takers, exceptional professional risk-takers. I have just the risk for you to take. You might even enjoy it.
That might have been true, said Locke, before you told us about the cider.
Obviously I know that what I've done will give you cause to bear me malice. Appreciate my position. I've done this to you because I respect your abilities. I can't afford to have you in my service without controls. You're a lever and a fulcrum, you two, looking for a city to turn upside down.
Why the hell couldn't you just hire us?
How would money be sufficient leverage for two men who can conjure it as easily as you?
So the fact that you're screwing us like a Jeremite cot doxy is really a very sweet compliment, said Jean. You fucking...
Calm down, Tannen, said Stragos.
Why should he?
Locke straightened his sweat-rumpled tunic and began tying his wrinkled neckcloths back on in an agitated huff.
You poisonous! Lay a mysterious task at our feet and offer no pay. You complicate our lives as coster and deferrer, and you expect to summon us at your leisure when you condescend to reveal this chore? Gods! What about expenses? Should we incur them?
You shall have any funds and material you require to operate in my service. And before you get excited, remember that you'll account for every last centera properly.
Oh, splendid. And what other perquisites does this job of yours entail? Complimentary luncheon at the barracks of your eyes? convalescent beds when Requin cuts our balls off and has them sewn into our eye sockets? I am not accustomed to being spoken to in this... Get accustomed to it! Snapped Locke, rising out of his chair and beginning to dust off his coat. I have a counter-proposal, one I urge you to entertain quite seriously.
Oh?
Forget about this, Stragos. Locke drew on his coat, shook his shoulders to settle it properly, and gripped it by the lapels. Forget about this whole ridiculous scheme. Give us enough antidote, if there is one, to settle us for the time being, or let us know what it is and we'll have our own alchemists see to it with our own funds. Send us back to Requin, for whom you profess no love, and let us get on with robbing him. Bother us no further, and we'll return the favour.
What could that possibly gain me?
My point is more that it would allow you to keep everything you have now.
My dear Lamora, laughed Stragos, with a soft, dry sound like an echo inside a coffin. Your bluster may be sufficient to convince some sponge-spined Komori mongrel Don to hand over his coin purse. It might even be enough to see you through the task I have in mind. But you're mine now, and the Bonds Magi were rather clear on how you might be humbled.
Oh? How's that, then?
Threaten me one more time, and I shall have Jean returned to the sweltering room for the rest of the night. You may wait, chained outside in perfect comfort, imagining what it must be like for him. And the reverse, Jean, should you decide to wax rebellious.
Locke clenched his jaw and looked down at his feet. Jean sighed, reached over and patted him on the arm. Locke nodded very slightly.
Good. Stragos smiled without warmth. Just as I respect your abilities, I respect your loyalty to one another. I respect it enough to use it for good and for ill. So you will want to come at my summons and accept the task I have for you. It's when I refuse to see you that you will begin to have cause for concern.
So be it, said Locke. But I want you to remember.
Remember what?
That I offered to let this go, said Locke. That I offered to simply walk away.
Gods, but you do think highly of yourself, don't you, Master Lamora?
Just highly enough. No higher than the Bonds Magi, I'd say.
Are you suggesting that Carthane fears you, Master Lamora? Please. If that were so, they would have killed you already. No, they don't fear you. They want to see you punished. Giving you over to me to suit my own purposes seems to accomplish that in their eyes. I dare say you've good reason to bear them malice.
Indeed, said Locke.
Consider for a moment, said Stragos, the possibility that I might not like them any more than you do, and that while I might use them out of necessity and freely accept windfalls they send in my direction, your service on my behalf might actually come to work against them. Doesn't that intrigue you?
Nothing you say can be taken in good faith, Locke glowered.
Ah, that's where you're wrong, Lamora. With the benefit of time, you'll see how little need I have to lie about anything. Now, this audience is over. Reflect on your situation and don't do anything rash. You may remove yourselves from the Mon Magisteria and return when summoned.
Wait, said Locke. Just... The Archon rose, tucked the file under his arm, turned and left the room through the same door he'd used to enter. It swung shut immediately behind him with the clatter of steel mechanisms.
Hell,
said Jean. I'm sorry, muttered Locke. I was so keen to come to Tal fucking Varar. It's not your fault. We were both eager to hop in bed with the wench. It's just shit luck she turned out to have the clap.
The main doors to the office creaked open, revealing a dozen eyes waiting in the hall beyond. Locke stared at the eyes for several seconds, then grinned and cleared his throat.
"Oh, good! Your master has left strict instructions placing you at our disposal. We're to have a boat, 8 rowers, a hot meal, 500 solari, 6 women who know how to give a proper massage, and..."
One thing Locke would say for the eyes was that when they seized him and Jean to escort them from the Mon Magisteria, they were firm without being needlessly cruel. Their clubs remained at their belts, and there were a minimal number of body blows to soften the resolve of their prisoners. All in all, a very efficient bunch to be manhandled by.